Centre at 6. Boris Johnson's ruled out an election pact with Nigel Farage. The Brexit Party leaders launched his campaign by demanding the Prime Minister scrap his withdrawal deal with the EU, or he'll put up candidates against the Tories. But the PM had this message for anyone thinking of switching their vote from the Conservatives.
The only likely consequence of voting for them rather than for us as Conservatives is One Nation Conservative. The only consequence is that you're making it more likely that you will thereby get Jeremy Corbyn.
Mr Johnson's also apologised for missing his October the 31st deadline for leaving the European Union. In other news, a man's facing extradition from Ireland after being charged with 39 counts of manslaughter over the deaths of migrants found in a lorry in Essex. Meanwhile, officers have revealed they've had a phone call with one of the two brothers wanted for questioning over the case. It's claimed a faulty window was to blame for the death of a baby who fell from a block of flats in North London. The 18-month-old boy passed away in hospital after it happened in Tottenham yesterday. It's emerged ASDA workers are to be given until Sunday next week to agree to new contracts. A union wants the supermarket to remove the threat of the sack for those who don't agree to the new terms, which the firm insists are fair. Turning to sport, and the Queen sent a good luck message to England's rugby union team ahead of their World Cup final tomorrow. She sent her best wishes for a memorable and successful match against South Africa. Her grandson will be in the crowds in Yokohama, and England flanker Sam Underhill says he's already been in touch.
Prince Harry sent us a nice message of support, which was nice to receive. Showed his little lad in an England shirt, so that was a nice touch.
And Wales have finished fourth at the World Cup. They lost 40-17 to dominant New Zealand in the bronze medal match in Japan. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news was meant to be the Conservative Party's Bristol Mayor candidate in next May's election, Samuel Williams. He sends his apologies, had to pull out earlier today due to an unexpected meeting that he's at now. Here in the flesh is, elected as a Tory, now a Lib Dem councillor for Brislington East, Tony Carey. We're also joined by Bristol van dwellers Rhiannon Bissot and Becky Jessen. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the US-owned Comcast news at 7, general election terror attacks. Well, we had three: Westminster Bridge, Manchester Arena and London Bridge in the run-up to the 2017 general election. So why do terrorists choose to do their attacks during election campaigns? Are the authorities better prepared, more importantly, this time? Advocating terrorist attacks against their own Israeli state. Well, this was terrorist attacks. The B'nai B'rith in the United States had to expel members of their group, the Israeli pressure group, in the early 1990s for actually advocating terrorist attacks against their own state. Plus, we go back to look at the history of war and terrorism in the young Israeli state between Zionist terrorists and the British Army. Also, vaccines. More information this week that 1990 Gulf War syndrome was caused not just by masses of immunisations given to soldiers before they flew out to fight in Kuwait and Iraq, but that some of those vaccines had never been tested on humans before. Were the soldiers in fact guinea pigs? What are the implications for the scores of vaccines given to every newborn child today? Is there a profit motive behind compulsory max vaccination? And why are so many mums trusting to natural immunity rather than injections? Are they being demonised as anti-vaxxers for doing what they believe is best for their children? And also the JFK assassination solved, but then the CIA tried to kill Grassy Knoll hitman James Files twice. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast news at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows around 10 Celsius. There's some light rain this weekend, highs at 14. Strong winds and heavy rain tomorrow, but light rain on Sunday. So Sunday, definitely the better day for going out. Next week, highs of 11, same sunny spells and patchy rain and windy at times. Next weekend, the 9th and 10th of November, highs around 9 Celsius, heavy showers and windy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is the Conservative... Well, no, he's not, sorry. It was going to be Conservative Party's Bristol Mayor candidate. A former Conservative councillor is here, though, Tony Carey, now Lib Dem. Can you tell us, Tony, why you switched to the Lib Dems?
I wasn't what I would call a true Tory. I was definitely a bit of a loose cannon as far as they were concerned.
But hang on, you were elected as a Tory.
I
so
was.
People thought you were when they were voting for you.
I think those who really knew me, and I think in my community I'm pretty well known. I've lived there literally all my life. I've been running various community groups since my teens in there. My whole family have always lived there. Yeah, we've all been involved in community activities there. So I think those who really knew me understood that I wasn't a true Tory. I was asked by the Tories twice to stand, and they were very kind to put up the bill. But there comes a time in a man's life when a man's got to do what a man's got to do. And when you elect someone like their current leader, I thought, that's it. That's the straw. And I just walked away because I really do not want to be associated with a person of that.
Oh, okay. What's the big difference between Boris and Theresa May, for example, then?
Well, I don't think... It's a bit of a challenge, this one. If Mrs. May came up your garden path and wanted to take your son out or go out with your son, you would probably think, what a nice person she is. But if Boris Johnson walked up your garden path and asked to take your daughter out, would you not flinch at least? I find the bloke's morals abhorrent, and I really don't want to have anything to do with him.
Well, what specifically has he done? How has he behaved?
Well, I find that he, with one wife, he then took on another mistress, and then with another wife, he took on another mistress, and now we finally got another one running alongside that as well. So he's double banking, apart from being married too. I mean, the poor bloke, he must go home at weekends for a rest.
So we've got an announcement this week of a general election, Tony. So
yes.
Which way will you be voting now?
There's only one way to vote now. Oh, sorry, do you want a specific? I should be voting for the Lib Dem candidate. But let me also say that we are able to identify that, yeah, we aren't going to be the senior party or the biggest party in Parliament at the end of this general election. What we do expect, though, is to win sufficient seats to make our presence felt.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, or Republican activist, we don't know quite how to describe you these days, but anyway, what's your thoughts about this? Because the Labour Party is sort of caught between two stools in this general election, isn't it?
Well, I mean, obviously, because the bigger a party is, the more difficult it is to hold it together.
What is the Brexit policy for the Labour Party?
Well, the Brexit policy is fairly clear. I mean, there's going to be some kind of a deal done, either this one that's on the table or another one, probably a softer version of Brexit, and then that will have to be put back to people in a vote so they can choose between the deal or Remain. And personally, I think if you've got a sort of deal that's basically the same as Remain, apart from just changing the names, you might as well just Remain. And that would be my view, and that's probably the majority view in the Labour Party.
Okay, we'll be talking about the election a bit more. General election announced this week, a little bit later on. But I'm also joined in the studio by Rhiannon Craft and Becky Jessen. Hi, you two.
And
you are both travellers, and you're involved in really helping to push the case for people living in vehicles in the city. I suppose the first obvious question, and I'll ask you one by one, Rhi, you first, is why live in a vehicle? It's so insecure. Most people want to live in a house.
So people live in vehicles for lots of different reasons. Some people have quite mobile lifestyles, so that means they need to move around a lot, so being in a movable dwelling is much more suitable. Other people are choosing it as an alternative form of housing that they can actually afford in a city where house prices are getting really high up. Some people also like to live on sites, which is quite a different dynamic, really, to a shared house, for example, where you have your own private dwelling within a communal space. So, and there's so many reasons I couldn't really go into now. For me personally, it was more the site dynamic that I really liked, having spent a lot of time on site as a teenager. So that was my reason personally, but I'll pass to Becky because she's a bit different.
So my reason really was because I was really keen to have my own home. I was fed up of, you know, being in renting accommodation, which was extremely expensive, and never really feeling like that was home. You know, you're very limited as to how much you can make that your own home. And you're completely aware that I wouldn't get a mortgage. I couldn't afford to buy a house. And even if I could stretch to that in some way, that was going to lock me into sort of 30 to 40 years of like huge financial pressure. So it's trying to find an alternative housing situation where I could have my own home and still have a really good work-life balance.
You know, there's one thing that strikes me as really irritating about renting, and that is any time and trouble you put into the fabric of the building, the garden, it actually doesn't go to you, does it? It goes to the landlord.
Yeah, and also actually you often can't put that time and effort in because the landlords themselves don't want you to do anything to the building. I once had a landlady literally have a panic attack because I put something on the wall with white tack. You know, there's no way of making that your home when you're limited in, you know, little things you can do to try and make it your own.
Really, tell us a bit about life on site. What makes that different to, say, for example, I don't know, living in a tower block or something, or even in a suburban estate?
Well, I've never lived in a tower block, so I can't talk about that. But for me personally, I just really enjoyed having my own private space where I had my own kitchen, I could cook whatever I want, have whatever food I want, but also having a communal space where I could spend time with other people. So I felt that I really had the choice to either opt into communal, like socialising, get in the communal space, or I could just have my own private space as well that was, like Becky saying, totally my own space that was under my own control.
But I mean, surely if you're on site, the communal space is open to the stars. If it's raining, it's not much of a place to be.
It depends on the site you're on, because we actually had a really big gazebo in the centre of our site, but then some people don't have that. So it depends on the site. Sites take lots of different formations.
Okay, look, the bottom line has got to be money. So roughly, what are we talking about here? Every week, your outgoings, or every month, your outgoings, having to live in private rented, which is most people is the only choice when they're looking for somewhere immediately. And on site, and what sort of difference are we talking about, monthly or weekly? I'll put you on the spot there. But I mean, this is
So just to give you an idea, like when I was renting, the last rented property I had, I was paying £580 a rent in rent a month. At the moment, I do pay a small amount of rent for where I'm parked, but that's £100. So obviously both of those have bills to consider, but your bills in a vehicle are much lower because you're using a lot less gas, and you don't, you know, I have solar panels, I don't pay for my electricity. So the financial freedom for me was a massive thing. You know, for me, it wasn't so much about being mobile, it was actually making sure you maintain that freedom and that I had the financial freedom to not have to work 50, 60 hours a week just to pay for a place.
So has it been a weight off your mind, not having to pay so much just to stand still every month?
Yeah, for sure. Like it's a great weight off your mind. It also allows you the freedom to make choices about the work that you like to do. You know, sometimes you are choosing the jobs you do purely based on the outgoings you need to meet, whereas having lower outgoings, you know, you can actually choose things that you'd really like to do. And also it means I have more free time. I freelance, I work less hours, and I have more free time to volunteer. So I'm super busy, but I'm doing lots of different things that I really, really want to do.
Now, Tony, you're a bog standard Bristol City Councillor. What do you make of the way these ladies are living?
I was saying earlier on, I'm a little bit jealous that they have this element of freedom that perhaps a house dweller who has to, as you say, meet quite a significant set of bills each week, each month, each year, perhaps doesn't have. So, but much as I love my house and I wouldn't want to move because I think I've put my own stamp on it now. Yeah, I do appreciate the point that Rhea's making. You know, she's living on site in a community with her own friends. When I shut my front door, that's it. You know, I don't know what's going on outside. You know, the house is double glazed. Unless a bomb drops or an airplane flies over really low, I'm in my little box.
I mean,
box,
actually, we can be quite lonely in a suburban situation, can't we? You can sometimes live for years and years in a street and not know people living opposite next, even, well, maybe next door neighbours, immediate neighbours, but, you know, not knowing other people around you.
Well, this is true. And so the point that the ladies are making is perfectly acceptable, that in their environment, you walk outside of your van, or outside of your, whatever it is you're living in, you know, and you think, yeah, today there's somebody new. I'm going to go and talk to them in my street. Yes, I know my neighbours, probably four or five houses in each direction. But beyond that, I probably don't, although I've lived in this house now for over a decade.
Well, look, Rhea and Becky, what about the downsides? Do you ever feel vulnerable just living in a vehicle? I mean, you know, someone could crawl underneath it or whatever, you know, throw things at it if they were particularly so inclined. It's more vulnerable, really, than a house, isn't it?
I think, again, it depends on where you're parked up and how many people you've got around you. So on site, actually, most people don't just walk onto site unless they are supposed to be there. So actually, I feel that I'm really secure on a site. But I guess it will vary from person to person, depending on where they're parked up, really. What do you think, Becky?
Yes, I think definitely as a female who's parked up not in a site, there are some safety considerations. Like, you know, it's fairly isolated where I'm parked up. However, it's quite interesting because the times when I've been staying in other people's houses on my own, I feel like aware that I can't hear things in the rest of the house. So, you know, you're in a really small space in a vehicle or truck like I am. So I know instantly if there are people nearby, and you kind of get used to that noise. Whereas where I'm in a house, I feel quite vulnerable in the sense of I might not hear if somebody smashed a window downstairs. So I think there's pros and cons and just being sensible.
So what are the council up to? Bristol City Council apparently has brought in a new policy to do with the way they deal with travellers and people in tents, that sort of thing. Or is it just travellers?
Well, that's interesting you asked that, because they brought out a new vehicle dwelling policy recently. We seem to have been kind of grouped together with homeless people, with rough sleepers, which to begin with is actually pretty problematic.
What about the people who are living in... We've got a big harbour in the city, loads of people living in boats, for example. I would have thought you had probably more in common with them than you do with, say, street homeless people.
I'd say we do. Well, we're vehicle dwellers. We all live in vehicles. So there's there's obviously a lot of connections. Well, maybe not obviously, but there are a lot of connections between the van dwelling community and the boat dwelling community. A lot of people move between the two. I, for example, know a lot of people in the boat dwelling community, and some people have expressed interest in uniting actually as communities. But the legislation affects them. They have their own legislation that affects them.
Well, we must be dealing with thousands and thousands of people in the city living like this, possibly even tens of thousands. There's loads and loads of, there's canals as well as there are, there's the harbour, and then you lot too. So anyway, what the council, what they decided? What is there now their new strategy?
Okay, so they released a new policy on the 3rd of September this year. So
okay,
it's been in place
nearly
2 months.
I want to say at this point that I did phone the Bristol City Council earlier this week, the press office, and asked if someone could come down to explain their side of what's happening, but nobody got back to me on that. So anyway, thank goodness you're here.
Yes, well, we can talk about it, that's fine.
I'm not quite sure what we pay our council tax for, but anyhow, carry on.
But basically what the new policy, to put it really quickly, it's very much an enforcement policy that lays out a new process for managing vehicle dwelling encampments, and it's very enforcement orientated. So it seems that it's focused on speeding up existing enforcement powers, like, for example, the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act, which was brought out in 1994. And it's basically a process whereby a report is made either by a local resident or a neighbourhood enforcement team, which is a police-run enforcement team that will be patrolling, looking for encampments. An assessment will be made, and they will notify St Mungo's, which is a homeless charity. Data is collected on the encampments that are found, and then they make an assessment on whether or not the encampment is high impact or low impact. And high impact is determined by a few things. So, for example, the size and concentration of the encampment, waste disposal, noise levels, other environmental factors as well. Some of it's quite vague, like they say things like levels of obtrusiveness as well, and suitability of the encampments. There's quite a lot of subjective, quite ambiguous criteria there. And basically, the way that the policy then is carried out depends on whether or not it's considered high impact or low impact.
Okay, well, I had a chat to the police as well, who were much more cooperative and helpful. They came back and said, well, we do have a joint programme with the council, a new joint policy. We are the junior partners in that. The council will take the lead. But the police's attitude is basically, unless there's public order issues, we're not really interested. Now, it's very easy for the police to say that to me over the phone, but it might be that they do get involved if they're told to, specifically by council, say if someone's making complaints and things like that.
Well, I know I spoke to the neighbourhood enforcement team last week, and they said that they've already issued 7 notices, so eviction notices, using this new policy since the policy was carried out.
So is that the police or the council?
The neighbourhood enforcement team, and they are a police enforcement team. Yes, so it has been used, and they've also made 2 injunctions, which effectively bans people from carrying out a certain activity, which in this case is living in a vehicle in certain.
Sorry, in this case, it's living.
Yeah, you could put it like that. Yes, yes.
Okay, so how did they arrive at this policy? Did you guys get consulted or anything?
No. So our understanding of it is that it's essentially the council's reaction to a lot of pressure from the media. There was a lot of media attention around a growing community on Greenbank last year, and that was national media, not just local media.
Yes, and I spoke to some of the residents on Greenbank who were actually quite happy about the way people were there. I didn't speak to all of them, obviously, and they were saying, well, the main problem here is that the council are not providing enough litter bins and things for people to use. And this, I mean, the place, the Greenbank, was absolutely covered. It's probably something like 70 or 80 vehicles there. And it was obviously a hotspot for vehicle dwellers. But I mean, certainly not all of the local residents were hostile.
No, I mean, I think obviously mixed opinions on that, depending on who and the interaction they've had with people living there. The waste disposal and facilities is a common theme. It came up it comes up all the time from vehicle dwellers and house dwellers about the need for more facilities. And also there's certain things that have kind of, like with Greenbank, that are making vehicle dwellers cluster together, such as the increasing parking permit schemes in Bristol means that there are less places for people to park. Also the changing communities around Bristol. So, for example, you know, places like Easton have been changing very quickly, and some of the new residents might not be as welcoming to van dwellers as some of the previous residents. So bit by bit, vehicle dwellers are sort of have less and less places where they can actually park and end up in these clusters around the city. So,
but this new policy, do you feel like you've been listened to?
No, I think we feel fairly confident in saying that.
Well, that's a bit disappointing. Anyway, I'll put up some links on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to details of the new policy, possibly on the council website, maybe the Bristol Post. But I mean, what if you had your way, both of you, Ree first, then Becky, what do you think that the council should be doing here?
So I think we don't just need diverse enforcement procedures, we need diverse accommodation. So some people will want permanent sites to live on, like that's how I feel personally at this stage in my life, that could change. I think some people do need to move around, so transit sites would be great.
The council say that there are sites for travellers, for example there's one at Avonmouth apparently.
Can I interrupt you?
Yeah.
Yes, there is one at Avonmouth, which is not a lot of cop. If you're living in this area, you know, I mean, what's it to Avonmouth from here? 8 miles, you know, you've got to drag yourself 8 miles to go to work or whatever it is you do. You know, I mean, certainly you'll be wanting to get to the city, central area of the city.
as I
South Bristol
it,
doesn't have anywhere at
no,
all as far as
I understand.
Understand
it, Tony, the council has to provide these sites, but yes. It seems what they've done is they've provided them in places which are actually no good for anybody.
Absolutely.
Or very little. I mean, obviously, if there's people working down at Avonmouth, that's fine. The other thing it strikes me is if you drive around this city, particularly Temple Way, there's actually a lot of derelict land or empty land. There's loads around. Some of it has been sitting there for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years.
Absolutely.
And no one's been doing anything with it. So if you've been lobbying to try and get hold of some of that, it would be allowed to stay there.
So, both Rhea and I have actually had separate conversations with the council about these sites. And separately now, as vehicle dwelling community working together, we're actually trying to work out how we can utilise some of these sites and work with the council, or how we can actually create these sites for ourselves.
Well, you see, you know what the Mayor Marvin Rees might say here, he doesn't come on this programme, so we can't ask him, but he might say that, hang on, we don't want these kind of shanty towns appearing in the city centre.
Yeah, and I think that would obviously be something that we would contest, because just because you live in a vehicle does not mean you want to live in a shanty town. You know, we are talking about really good facilities. We're talking about even things like sites that are based on community housing models, something the government are really keen on at the moment. We're not looking to create vehicle shanty towns. We're looking to create alternative living solutions that provide a really good quality of life for everybody there and in the surrounding community.
Well, more power to your elbow, both of you, and let's hope that that sort of thing happens in the future. How do people listening, if they're interested, follow what you're doing and following the sort of traveller action scene, I suppose, or the lobby, the travellers' lobby in the city?
Ree has a blog, so if you, Ree, how can people find your blog?
I think the easiest way to find it would be to go on my Twitter, which is Rhiannon Craft. I'm the only Rhiannon Craft on there. It's Rhiannon, and it's a pinned post at the top. I would give you the whole URL, but it's quite lengthy.
And we also have a closed Facebook group, which is for people living in vehicles specifically, called Bristol Van Dwellers. So if you live in a vehicle and you want to keep an eye on what's going on and just chat with us, then the best way to do that is to join the Facebook group.
Well, Rhiannon Craft and Becky Jessen, thanks very much for joining us. But do stick with
thanks.
Us for a second, because we're going to be talking about housing again in a different way. A massive story this week is the initial report into the fire at Grenfell Tower in London years ago. And I spoke to one of the people who was on the scene, reacted to it with one of the first 999 calls back then. In 2017. His name is Joe Delaney, and he talks to me here about the response of the firefighters, because this is what the Prime Minister has been criticising and various people have been criticising. I mean, obviously the firefighters didn't cause the fire in the first place, and that part of the inquiry is going to come later, but there has been certainly some criticism of the way the firefighters responded, and Joe had this to say about that.
What I find most the most shocking element of that evidence was the fact that even people who were ringing them from inside the tower, for example, and saying, I'm on floor 21 or 22 and there's smoke on my floor and I can't get outside, even those people, they weren't taking seriously. And that was what took, that was one of the reasons that it took so long for the disaster to be scaled up. I mean, the guy who was there initially, Michael Dowden, he was completely out of his depth. This was the firefighter who was watch. He was watch commander initially. Now, he is qualified to deal with fires that are known as, he's allowed a maximum of a two-pump fire, as they call it. Two-pump fire means two engines is what's needed for the response. Immediately that night, that was a six-engine fire, and it went up, I believe, at most to 20-something engines were in the area dealing with it. So from the outset, he was out of his depth. It was the first time he'd ever commanded anything like that. And what he was expected to do on his first command was throw the rule book that he was taught out the window. You know, so I don't agree with the position he took, but I can understand why he took it. Why was there no one senior brought in quickly? Is it anything to do with the fact that, you know, there were 10,000 firefighters in this country in 2005, and I think we're barely over 5,000 now at the moment, you know? And that's why I found Prime Minister Johnson's speech today in the Commons to be particularly insulting to us in the area. and to the memories of those who died, because he's saying, you know, the authorities let them down. Well, you know, Prime Minister Johnson might be saying the authorities let us down. The problem is that it was Mayor Johnson who cut the fire service in London. And when he was questioned about that by Andrew Dismore at the London Assembly, this is online, when Andrew Dismore raised safety concerns and said, have you sort of assessed these cuts that you're planning to implement? Because it was something like 27 fire stations have been closed in London. And so that complement amount of personnel has gone as well. When Andrew Dismore asked him questions on that, he just said to him, get stuffed. That was his exact response to a member of GLA, you know, Greater London Authority representative, questioning the mayor on this issue. Get stuffed.
Tony, this is your Boris that you're complaining about. That was his reaction, apparently. And we'll hear it, actually, in a minute. I've got a recording of him saying that. Doesn't sound like a very sensitive way to react to cuts in the fire service.
Boris Johnson is one of those characters that I think if he were to walk in the door, we think, oh, that was a nice old chappy, you know, whoever he was, you know. But he is a product of an education system that I don't like. He is a product of a family, dynasty that is there to promote the Johnson brand. He is not a person who has ever in his life taken any training whatsoever in how things are done on a community basis.
Yeah, but he is elected and he's now Prime Minister.
Yes, but I can assure you I didn't blooming elect him.
Martin Summers. But what is it? Tony's talking here in a way about the whole Eton Bullingdon Club set, yeah. Isn't he?
Well, I went to Oxford University, but I didn't go to the Bullingdon Club because you've got to go to Eton as well if you're going to be in the Bullingdon Club.
Didn't they ask you?
No, well, that's right. They didn't ask me, Tony. I don't suppose I'd have said anything. Well, I think the thing about it is as Tony says, he's very much a product of that kind of conveyor belt. And of course, the other thing, I'm quite angry about the fire brigade being put the finger on them there, because in actual fact, they risked their lives that day to do the best they could. And of course, that block was designed in the 1970s to have no cladding on it, and therefore to be a concrete block. And Fielding Mellon, who was the chief guy in charge at the Kensington Council, another silver spoon Tory, decided they were going to put cladding on it, basically to keep the house prices up in the area. Yeah, because that's what Kensington is. It's a very, very posh area. It makes Snade Park look positively down market. And of course, the cladding was all wrong, and the fire brigade are working on the presumption that the building is supposed to be unclad, and therefore you keep people in the rooms because it's not going to spread.
The ultimate problem, it seems, would be the fire service cuts, because they said there was no senior person available to actually take on that fire.
Well, even if there had been a senior person available, the standard operating procedure was to leave people in the rooms. And of course, we now know not to do that, because there's loads of buildings around the country which have got cladding on, which is flammable cladding.
It's still there. And Joe talks about this in the interview, which you can hear next Tuesday lunchtime from 12 till 1, the Dialect programme here on BCFM. He goes into a lot more detail. But look, sir, Rhiannon and Becky are still here. Are you glad that you don't live in tower blocks after what happened there? I mean, what do you make of what lessons might be learned from Grenfell?
It's a really interesting situation where I feel like, you know, our top politicians are having some sort of bickering match and just playing a blame culture. I just can't believe really that you can run a dogma of austerity and then not accept the consequences of those cuts to services. And, you know, this is not a bickering match. This is people's lives. And if you're going to cut services and you believe in that dogma, then you have to accept the consequences of that.
Yeah, I completely agree, Becky. And it's another classic example of blaming individuals for broader structural problems, which we see happening a lot, unfortunately. And I think also considering, like, as people who live in vehicles, we quite often have people telling us our lifestyle's unsafe. But I think actually cutting services is unsafe.
Another aspect. Oh, sorry, Tony, yeah.
Well, the point I'm going to make there, in Bristol we have any number of what they call high rises, anything over it's 5 or 6 floors, none of the local authority properties are clad in this manner at all. And the fires we have seen in Bristol have all been contained exactly as the building was designed. We had one in my local high rise, you know, just a few streets away from me the other month, or maybe it's probably getting on for a year now, quite a significant fire in an apartment, and it stayed within that apartment. The only damage was really smoke damage outside the door, but the apartment itself was written off. You know, the council had to spend a lot of money to rebuild it, but the whole block was secure, and the folks just stayed where they were. They knew that in Bristol, there the high rises are safe. There are, unfortunately, high rises in Bristol that have the wrong stuff on. But
one of the things that Joe was saying is that nobody now believes this stay put policy anywhere in London. Certainly, I don't know about other parts of the country, but if there's a fire, they're going to get out as soon as they possibly can after what happened at Grenfell. It means that the official fire policies have basically been ripped up and thrown in the bin because of what happened there.
So the problem is now, when we have a fire, you've got, let's say we've got an 11-storey block of 11-storey block, maybe let's say six apartments on each block. So potentially you have 120, 180 people all rushing downstairs with the fire service are trying to get upstairs. And that's one thing. And then you're going to have 180 people uncontrolled running around, I'm using that metaphorically, outside the building. And what happens then is that when the windows fall out, there are 180 people who are in risk of being injured because that's what happens when buildings catch fire. Windows fall out, and as it was in Brissington, it was 10 stories up. And a window falling that sort of height can kill several people, you know. And so I'm a firm believer in the training was right, the policy was right, and in Bristol it has proven to be right. Unfortunately, the point Martin makes, that somebody here changed the whole character of the building from one which was fundamentally safe to one which was jolly well unsafe. And then all of a sudden now, someone who...
Well, I'll tell you who it was. No, it's not someone. It's a man called Rock Fielding Mellon. His family home is up at Cheltenham. It's called Stanway House, and anyone can go on a drive past it if they want to. It's an extremely posh country manor, probably put there after the local peasants were evicted when the land was enclosed. So nothing's happened to him at all. He still walks the streets. So it may be possibly he will have his collar felt, but one does wonder whether, because he's part of this kind of conservative elite, that he may just get off scot-free.
I would suspect, I believe that he will get off scot-free. And I was watching the that TV series, The Accident, this week, and the guy comes along and he's speaking to the mother of the daughter who was injured, and he was rattling off all these major catastrophes we have experienced in Great Britain over the last 50 years, and all the number of people who have been bought to book for this. None.
Well, that's right. Joe says the corporate manslaughter laws are totally inadequate. Anyway, before you go, Ree and Becky, one of the things that I found quite irritating was the way that the council, maybe it's the police, maybe it's the council, anyway, somebody is talking about there being mental health issues around living in vehicles, where actually, from what you've described to me, not having to find £1,000 a month just to sit still and go nowhere actually might be quite good for your mental health.
And we hear these stories all the time. From ourselves, we know, we understand this, but also people will tell us these stories of, you know, we were working 50 to 60 hours a week to try and pay for a damp, awful flat in Bristol. It was destroying us. You know, I was depressed. I was suffering from anxiety. I moved into a vehicle, you know, new life. So I'm not saying that's always the case, but I don't think it's fair in any way to assume that you're going to have poor physical or mental health because you've chosen to live in a vehicle.
To continue on that, like I, for example, me personally, my mental health is much better when I'm a PhD student. I actually can just do my PhD and do a little bit of work every now and then on top of it, rather than a lot of people I know that are paying really high rent prices will be trying to do a PhD whilst doing all sorts of other jobs on top, and that's obviously not very good for your mental health.
I'm thinking about Bristol University and its student suicide record as well, because it's the worst in the country. And if you're actually trying to do your studies as well as trying to make money, and you're being having to pay the sorts of rents that many of these students are, very, very high. Maybe they should be thinking about van dwelling. I mean, I think there's maybe something wrong with our society. It's this time of year, isn't it, where apples are on the trees. I mean, where's he going with this? Where apples are on the trees. I picked a whole load of apples the other day and just left them out on the street because you think, well, there's something for somebody there. Why can't everybody just have what's around? For goodness sake, there's loads of land. Why can't you guys have the land? There's loads of apples. In fact, many of the streets you drive down, you'll find them all lying in the gutter and rotting away. Why can't people just go and take those and have them?
We've got in Brissington again, a trading estate with good access to a good bus service, and some of these estates, or some of these sites, haven't been active for decades, and they're just being sat upon by some entrepreneurial development company.
You know what? They're speculators.
That's the word I'm after. And they're speculating on this, and nothing is going to happen to these until eventually someone in College Green says, let's develop Brissington Trading Estate into a housing estate. And then this land will suddenly, miraculously become available. I give Paul Smith and his crew the due in as much that they are endeavouring to force these people to sell, you know, by going for compulsory purchase orders so that good housing can be built. But I think that also we should be looking at not... We shouldn't be looking at 3- and 4-bedroom houses. We should be looking at 1- and 2-bedroom houses. So that old codgers like me, who live in a 2-bedroom... Okay, it's only a 2-bedroom one, but I can move to somewhere that is nice, that somewhere that is smaller, and my house then becomes available for folks to buy and bring the market down.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I mean, I think this is sort of tapping into a much deeper issue about land inequality in England. England has the most unequal land distribution in the whole of Europe, and I think it's about time that we start facing up to that and the roots of it. There's some interesting books, one called Who Owns England? And this is, you know, a topic that we don't have time to discuss now, but I think it's really, really important to remember how unequal our land distribution is and the roots of that.
I mean, ultimately, we could be looking at people, speculators, buying land and there being nothing left for the rest of us. They're just using it as money in the bank. Anyway, listen, fantastic. Ree and Becky, thanks ever so much for coming in. And we're going to give Tony his big treat now, which is Boris Johnson saying what he thinks about the fire service cuts.
How can cutting fire stations, cutting fire engines, cutting firefighters' posts not be a reduction in fire cover?
Because we're improving fire cover, as I've said several times. And it... By continuing to reduce deaths from fire and continuing to reduce the incidence of fire. That is the name of the game. It's not about...
You lied to the people of London in your
election. Oh, get stuck.
Well, there we are. Boris Johnson, as you say, telling people to get stuffed in his inimitable manner.
Okay, but there's a general election been announced this week, Martin, and it looks like he's doing very well in the polls. I've got a poll from the iPaper right here in front of me. Boris Johnson, best Prime Minister, 32%, Jeremy Corbyn, 13%. Joe Swinson, 11%, Nigel Farage, Brexit Party, 9%. Projection of the general election result right now is the Conservatives will win a majority with 354 seats. Labour will get 195 and SNP 48. Now, it's not looking good for Jeremy, is it? He got bounced into this. The Lib Dems and the SNP said, OK, we'll have an election. And Jeremy Corbyn had to go along with it, didn't he?
Ultimately, yes, there were political reasons. Well, I mean, I personally think he should have just hung tough and not gone for the election. But if you're going to, you know, it's too late to say that now. There is definitely one going to happen. And, of course, don't forget that he started off with even worse poll numbers last time round. And, of course, Boris Johnson, as we know, is quite capable of imploding when he's under pressure.
Well, I think that's a jolly good way of putting it. An implosion is... Jolly good way of putting it. Boris Johnson, as we know, when we, back in the days of the referendum, wrote two theories. What he was going to do if the Brexit deal was passed or if it failed. And he just, I'll take that plan out and off we go. I was going on about my military service earlier on. I've met plenty of Boris Johnsons in my military time. They are a product of their families and their wealth. They haven't a clue about leadership in any way, shape or form. Boris has shown his true colours by how he reacted to Theresa May when she was asking for his support. He's shown his true colours, and he shouldn't be surprised when the Conservatives now look around at him and react similarly.
One of the big supporters of Jeremy Corbyn has always been George Galloway, Martin, but he has a few harsh words for Jeremy Corbyn's present policy. He thinks that he's explaining, trying to explain anyway here, why Corbyn and the Labour Party are so low in the polls.
Emily Thornberry, Keir Starmer and John McDonnell all addressed on a platform with Michael Heseltine, who shut down the coal mines in Britain, all announced, A, that Labour is a Remain party, which its conference decided not to say, and all demanded a referendum on Boris Johnson's deal. A complete brazen defiance of their own conference policy of last month and of their own shadow cabinet policy of last week, because both of these demanded a general election first, then a Labour deal, which then Jeremy Corbyn would remain neutral on. He's lost control of the Labour Party.
Well, I don't see where George is going with that, because in actual fact, that is exactly what's happening. There's a general election first, and the policy is to have a referendum on the back of that with a deal, not necessarily Johnson's deal. If Johnson had decided to push his own deal, which had a majority of 30, we wouldn't be having a general election. And that's the whole purpose of the Fixed-Term Parliament Act, which was rammed down our throats all those years ago, to create stability in the middle of financial crisis, so that you can't just have elections. Now, I didn't agree with it, but those are the rules, and the reason for the rules is that you don't want to have random elections in the middle of a parliament. And in actual fact, what they could easily have done is debated this deal, which is a rubbish deal in various ways. But of course, it would have been amended, and of course, he doesn't want it amended.
And there are quite a lot of we're going to be hearing Jeremy Corbyn and his election launch in a minute. There are quite a lot of people in the trade union movement, Martin, who think that actually we would be a lot easier to do all the nationalisations that Jeremy Corbyn's talking about if we're outside the EU because of their state aid rules.
Well, I think you'll find that the trade union movement is there's a small Leave section, but the TUC, Francis O'Grady and the others have all been very strongly Remain, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, that's fine. But what about the actual unions themselves, the rail unions? Do you remember Bob Crowe? He was very anti-EU. Yeah. Well, he's got a new guy taken over from him now. Yeah. So let's have a listen to him.
The idea that we're going to get a deal isn't true. Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party can't negotiate one. I'll tell you why. Any trade unionist in the country looking at this, you won't go into negotiations to negotiate a tea break with no deal on the table, much less a withdrawal agreement. And then even if they do manage to negotiate a withdrawal agreement, they're then going to put it in a referendum and campaign against it, a deal that they've just negotiated. It's complete nonsense. So it shows clearly the only way out of the European Union now is to leave without a deal and then negotiate an agreement afterwards. And it's worth noting, when we talk about trust in politicians, we elected this group of Labour MPs on a ticket of respecting the referendum. There isn't a single socialist policy in a manifesto that wouldn't come up against or be prevented by a membership of the European Union. In my industry, we can't renationalise the railways because of the EU fourth rail package. We couldn't take the post office back into public ownership for the same reason. We couldn't take all of the outsourced council services back in-house because of EU procurement laws. We couldn't take contracts in the NHS over €750,000 back into public ownership because of EU procurement laws. So I don't want to return to a Labour Party where we're just going to go back and do public spending like the Blair era. I really want to change the country. You can't do that in the European Union. Nobody's going to negotiate
a
deal.
But you're comfortable with no deal?
Well, it's the only way out, you see, because think about it from this perspective. They want us to enter into a negotiating scenario where there's no imperative on either side to negotiate a deal. I don't know if you've seen the film The Godfather, you know, when he says, "I'll make you an offer you can't refuse." Well, having no deal on the table is like walking into the room and saying, "I want you to make me a deal I can't refuse."
Okay, a quick response.
And then they're going to campaign against it.
So that's, I'm not quite sure what that chap's name is. He's, I think, Assistant General Secretary of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, Steve Headley, Martin. Yeah. He's making a pretty strong case. So he says, look, my industry, Jeremy Corbyn can talk all he wants about renationalising it, but unless the he's out of the single market, he's not going to be able to do it.
It's simply wrong.
At the moment, we're part of the single market, obviously. That has within it restrictions on state aid and state spending. That has pressures on it through the European Union to privatise rail, for example, and other services. I think we have to be quite careful about the powers we need as national governments.
You mentioned state aid. Can you give me an example of the kind of thing you would like to do that membership of the EU stops you doing?
I would have wanted us to intervene immediately on SSI Redcar when the steel industry was in a crisis at that time. The government claimed there were issues of state aid. We disputed that at the time. But I would also want to say that we would want to be able to invest in industries.
Don't forget, the front, even the Tories are going to talk about, they're going to put the rail industry back in public ownership because, or into not-for-profit. Because
what
all
about
based,
council services? It's all based he talked on, about council.
Let me just talk about
there,
the rail industry in particular. It's all done on franchises. So all you do is you don't renew the franchise. That's what happened with the West Coast mainline.
But then apparently, if another company comes along and makes an offer, you have to consider
well,
it.
Well, the EU procurement rules are a problem. But there'd be a if you think that having Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage running it would lead to a situation where they are going to renationalise stuff, this Lexit position
is wrong.
Well,
I don't think
wrong.
Steve Headley is saying.
No, I know, but so is he going to vote for Farage and, so, and No Deal, or is he going to vote for? Or is he going to vote Labour?
Well, I imagine we'll vote for a Labour MP.
Well, in that case, he's got to go along with the majority view, which is that we can't just we've been in the EU since 1973. Well, we can't just throw it over.
What do you make about this business of state aid, Tony, and the EU?
My thoughts on that, I will confess not having been totally up to speed on this at all, but what I understand is that the strong traditional Labour areas voted quite overwhelmingly to leave. If the unions then do anything other than support those industrial areas, they will also be weakened. For sure, Labour has been very weakened in these industrial, traditional Labour areas. And if that's a measured response to say, look, we need to leave Europe before we can do any rebuilding, well, I think that's the whole point of this. This is the whole point of leaving Europe. We perceived that we had lost sovereignty. We had lost our ability to make our own laws. In actual fact, that isn't exactly true at all. But this is the perception. So let's get out of Europe one way or another. Now, that's not the Lib Dem point of view. No. My personal point
okay.
of view.
Well, Tony, it's good for you to confess that you're not agreeing with your party on everything, which is quite refreshing, actually. The Labour Party launched their election campaign this week. We'll probably have the Conservatives next week and others, Brexit Party today. But let's have a listen to some of Jeremy Corbyn's speech.
Friends, today is the 31st of October. It's all right, I'm just passing on information to you at this stage. The day that Boris Johnson promised we would leave the EU, he also said he would rather be dead in a ditch than delay beyond today. But he has failed, and that failure is his alone. You can't trust the word. After 3 long years of Brexit division and failure from the Tories, we have to get this issue sorted out, as Marsha pointed out. We need to take it out of the hands of politicians and trust the people to have the final say. Labour will get Brexit sorted within 6 months. We'll let the people decide whether to leave on sensible deal or remain. It really isn't that complicated. And we, a Labour government, will carry out whatever the people decide, so we can then get on with delivering the real change that Britain needs after years of Conservative cuts to vital services and tax handouts to the richest. Labour is determined to bring a divided country together, while the Tories and the Liberal Democrats only seek to divide us further. The Liberal Democrats want to cancel a democratic vote with a parliamentary stitch-up, and Boris Johnson's planned trade deal with Trump will mean yet more National Health Service money taken away from patients and handed to shareholders. Despite his denials, the NHS is up for grabs by US corporations in a one-sided Trump trade sellout. Channel 4 dispatches revealed this week that the cost of drugs and medicines has repeatedly been discussed between the US and British trade officials. Remember Johnson's famous promise of $350 million a week for the NHS? Well, his toxic Brexit trade deal with Trump could hand over $500 million a week of NHS money to big drug corporations in America and around the world. We will stop them. Labour won't let Donald Trump get his hands on our National Health Service. Our NHS, created by our communities and brave people that campaigned in centres like this to get an NHS, I simply say quite bluntly to everyone, it's not for sale.
Jeremy Corbyn getting a big round of applause there for that, Martin. But actually, it was only a very, very small part of his speech. Most of it was about things like the National Health Service.
Well, I think he did a very good job at Prime Minister's questions of pointing out the danger of the health service. Trump intervened in our election this week, saying
he doesn't want Corbyn. No, and it's interesting, isn't it? What I will do is I'll put a full link up to Corbyn's speech launching the campaign on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Yeah.
He's actually coming to Bristol tomorrow. He's going to be speaking in Filton at a rally. And of course, all the people cheering are basically his supporters. So it's not like, you know, that's not quite the same thing.
But he may be talking to the electorate. Definitely got the rock star spirit, but he's really, really low in the polls at the moment. Yeah. He's not going to win, is he?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I think he's a Marmite politician, a bit like George Galloway or Arthur
Scargill. Isn't he trying to convince himself and the voters that this election is nothing to do with Brexit?
Oh, yeah, because basically what he did last time in the 2017 is that the Tories are all going on about Brexit, and we're actually talking about universal credit. We're actually talking about housing.
Can you make the general election, do you think, about domestic issues?
Well, I think that is definitely... We've wasted an awful lot of time on this nonsense. That's what I would say about it. It's an obsession of the right wing in this country to leave Europe, and the complications are enormous. Just think of all the implications for the Irish peace agreement.
And what about those Labour people? Nobody talked about that during the election campaign. Keir Starmer, etc., that said we will honour the referendum. No, no.
We lost the referendum. Yes, the result was close. Yes, there were lies and half truths, none worse than the false promise of £350 million a week for the NHS. Yes, technically the referendum is not legally binding, but the result was not technical. It was deeply political. And politically, the notion that the referendum was merely a consultation exercise to inform Parliament holds no water. When I was imploring people up and down the country to vote in the referendum and vote to remain, I told them their vote really mattered. That a decision was going to be made. I was not inviting them to express a view. Yeah. And although we are fiercely internationalist and fiercely pro-European, we are in the Labour Party above all Democrats. Yeah. Had the outcome been to remain, we would have expected the result to have been honoured. And that cuts both ways. A decision was made on the 23rd of June last year to leave the EU. Two-thirds of Labour MPs represent constituencies that voted to leave. One-third represent constituencies that voted to remain. This is obviously a difficult decision. I wish the result had gone the other way. I campaigned passionately for that. But as Democrats, our party has to accept the result.
What we said is we are going to honour the referendum result. We're going to get a deal and then we're going to have a vote on it. Just as a trade unionist would say, we've voted to go on strike. We're on strike. We've got a deal. Now, do you want to accept it, membership?
Well, I also spoke earlier this week to NHS Dr. Bob Gill, who's absolutely convinced that the National Health Service is being stealthily privatised.
Generally speaking, anybody with a public service ethos who still believes in the NHS should be a public service, free at the point of use, funded through taxation, they are no longer there. Can you think of anybody in senior management who truly believes in the NHS? The rhetoric is there, but the reality is anybody who is a potential obstacle within the senior echelons of the NHS has gone. Even at a more local level, there's a continual turnover of senior managers. They come into a hospital trust or a clinical commissioning group. They're there for 2 or 3 years. They push through their cuts and closures and reforms, and then they move on, never to have to witness the consequences of their actions. And this is quite a deliberate policy. Without the compliant and fully complicit senior management across the NHS, none of this would be possible. I'll give you one name, Mr. Simon Stevens, who was formerly Tony Blair's health advisor. In 2004, went over to United Health, spent 10 years there, left as the president of global expansion in 2014 to become chief executive of NHS England. And all the reforms he's putting in, all the restructures he's putting in, are modeled on the private insurance line. So if there was any exponent of the revolving door that needs everybody's attention, it's him.
Well, it's interesting that he's been working for a Labour government, because I understand that Sir Oliver Letwin, he's a Conservative MP and has been involved in the whole Brexit business quite centrally. He penned a document which proposed a way to privatise the National Health Service.
Yes, so Letwin not only wrote a pamphlet on privatising the NHS called Britain's Biggest Enterprise, that was back in 1988. He also wrote a book called Privatising the World in the same year. And that set out how to break up and asset strip all the public services and all the public utilities. And most of that has been done. The NHS has been the hardest to do because it's so beloved and trusted of the public. So it's taken them a lot longer to achieve what they wanted to achieve with the NHS, but we're nearly there. In fact, Letwin was caught off guard in a meeting and said, within 5 years of the next Tory government, the NHS will be privatised. And he said that it should have all been over by 2015, if you take him at his word. It's taken them longer than expected because there has been a pushback with campaign groups fighting for their local hospitals and others raising concern. But you're exactly right. The blueprints were written by Letwin, John Redwood, and also the think tanks like the Adam Smith Institute, who wrote a paper called The Health of Nations, again, outlining how to get from a public service to a fully privatized insurance-based system without too many people noticing.
So that's a Blairite there, Martin. It's apparently taking over the whole of NHS, and he was one of the people that started the whole PFI process.
Well, indeed. I mean, as you know, hospitals are tied into these ridiculous contracts, and it was a lot of them signed during the Blair-Brown era. Ridiculous. Why did we do that?
Yes, so the NHS is going to be privatised. One of the things is also the main person behind it all is a chap called Sir Oliver Letwin, who's standing down at this general election. He's one of the big cheerleaders for Remain in the Conservative Party.
Well, who's speaking?
Sorry, go on, Martin.
I mean, yes, but I mean, the point is that the Brexit debate has split faces people all over the place. I mean, George Galloway, for example, voted against independence for Scotland. That's why he doesn't stand in Scotland anymore, because the Scots don't really like it.
Oliver Letwin seems to think that leaving the EU would allow the British people to have more control about over the National Health Service.
Well, Oliver Letwin is in favour of Boris Johnson's deal. I am not. He is. Basically, the real problem of the stealth privatisation of the health service has been going on for years. But you saw what happened this week when Trump phoned into Farage's phone programme.
Okay, so final point. We've got a diesel zone coming in, apparently, Tony. What on earth is that about?
The mayor doesn't really seem to know. That's a right old Horlicks, that is. I'm telling you.
We took the extra time before we announced the scheme that we're pursuing to take all that into account. So what I'm saying is, these are not new, the questions. You're not revolutionary to us.
No, I know, but what's the solution? I know you've taken time to think about it, but are you going to allow my delivery man into Bristol in his van?
Well, that is now the next stage. And we've got a process we need to work through. It's just legally bound up as well. So I can't say specifically at this stage what measures will be taking place. What I can say is that we have already got people thinking about the mitigations that we will need to put in place to make sure that people in Bristol are not adversely impacted unduly, but without undermining the integrity of our need to deliver clean air. And we have both a moral, ecological and a legal duty to deliver clean air for the people of Bristol. We're going to do that, but we're going to take care of people's incomes in the process.
It's absolutely ludicrous. Now, what he's trying to do is ban diesel vehicles from a certain small area of the city centre. Now,
well, it's from Hot Wheels all the way up to Cabot Circus, isn't it? And there's a little, you know, Temple Meads.
Yeah, I say small. I mean, when you consider that for this to be of any use, you need a much larger area. You need an inner ring road that allows people to get around the city centre easily. You need an outer ring road. Well, we've got and neither are complete. And are you really now going to say, right, you're delivering, you've forked out your hundreds of thousands of pounds, something goes wrong with your electric vehicle or whatever vehicle it is.
This is, I mean, and you've got potentially an election loser for Marvin Rees. Anyway, time, thanks to our guests. That was elected as a Tory, now Lib Dem councillor for Bristol and East, Tony Carey. Plus, Bristol van dwellers Rhiannon and
Bristol's
Becky.
BCFM
join me after the US Own Comcast News at 7 as we take our weekly
online
look around the world.
On your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.